Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Dr. Donna Arnett is Dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Kentucky. Her particular expertise is in cardiovascular health and disease, metabolic diseases and nutrition, and stroke research. But today, we want to talk to her about public health in a pandemic. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Arnett.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
So from a public health perspective, what's on your short list of concerns as we continue to move through this coronavirus pandemic?
Well, the list could be long, Tom, but I'll try to keep it to what I think is the most pertinent. And so our risk for contracting the virus is the highest it's ever been because there are more people out in the community who have been infected or are currently infected. So for me, one of the major concerns is that we're in the midst of what I'm referring to as COVID fatigue. People are tired of being quarantined or isolated or separated from their family and experiencing that fatigue and letting their guard down. And because of that, I have concerns that we're going to continue this exponential growth of cases in Kentucky.
So far, knock on wood about this, we have escaped the overwhelming of ICUs and in our hospitals in Kentucky. I think I'm correct about that, right?
You are absolutely correct.
So even so, though, what kinds of strain is the pandemic placing on our public health system?
Well, public health in Kentucky in particular, but this is a national trend as well, has really been suffering for years with budget cuts and reductions in staff as people and communities are trying to make budgets. So our infrastructure has declined by about 30% over the last decade. So we entered this pandemic with a shortfall in both worker number and our budgets for local and state public health departments.
You know, I was aware of the underfunding, the staff shortages, and wondering if our county health departments are generally prepared to respond to any additional demands on services in the event that something we're not even expecting happens while the pandemic is going on.
Right. You know, one thing about public health is that we rise to the occasion when needed, and that is true for our local public health departments. They are working, in many cases, 7 days a week to try to get the contact tracing done so that we can identify people who may have been exposed to a case. You know, they're really rising to the occasion in doing that, but a lot of them are really underfunded. And, you know, one thing we haven't heard about recently in Kentucky is a shortfall in many budgets because of the state retirement system. And so many local public health departments were on the verge of going under when that whole conversation started. And so it's really a very important time for the public to know their local health department and what their needs are.
Well, it's really hard to sustain going the extra mile and rising to the occasion, as you put it. And I wonder, are there signs of stress among our public health care workers?
Absolutely. And you know, what's really interesting, Tom, is, and this also is a national trend, a lot of public health officials who are out in the front with their governors are leaving the position because they're getting death threats. So it's a really interesting, very challenging time for those who are in leadership positions in public health. Many of them are retiring early because of the negative sentiments of many in the populace who don't understand the importance of the mitigation measures being implemented.
Okay, death threats? What's going on there? What's happening?
Well, I think, you know, the conflict between what is individual rights and state rights has really been front and center during this pandemic. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, in 1918, the Spanish flu pandemic, there was the same kind of civil unrest around mask wearing then. So it seems to be an American trait that we don't want to be told to wear a mask or to socially distance.
What is your response? What are you to say, Dr. Arnett, to those whose confidence in science has been shaken by all the political rhetoric that's going on these days?
As a person who's devoted my life to science, it really is a very sad time for me because science is really the foundation of public health. Epidemiology, you know, I'm an epidemiologist. It's the core discipline of public health. And really, it's sad that people don't understand the importance of following science and understanding that public health at its basic foundational nature is science.
Are you concerned that the conflicting messaging that has been surrounding the Centers for Disease Control during this outbreak has confused the public and maybe damaged the public's trust in public health?
Yes and no. I mean, I think, first of all, the CDC should be the authority, the go-to place for information. They are a science-based organization and should be free from interference with any kind of governmental overreach. So it is worrisome that there does appear to be political pressure in what they're able to say, and that needs to stop.
Well, I wonder what you're seeing there at the university. Has all this conflicting information in some way discouraged young people who might have been considering careers in public health?
Actually, it's had quite the opposite effect. So nationally, the field has grown in numbers of applicants this year. When people are hearing epidemiology and public health front and center on their news reports every night, it's really helped to show the importance of the field. You know, public health, when it's working and working well, is kind of that actor behind the scenes that's taking care of making sure your water is clean and your food is safe and your vaccines are up to date. It's only when things go awry that people recognize that public health plays such an important role in society and population health.
So what sorts of lessons have been learned for the long term during this pandemic by the public health community?
Well, I think one of the first and probably most important lesson is that public health is really critical to our overall societal functioning from both a health perspective, but also an economic perspective. You know, it's really foundational that we understand epidemics, that we address them early. You know, another big learning from this is that this was a novel virus. So, you know, getting as much information about the virus as soon as we could was really helpful in mitigating the spread of the disease. As you said, you know, Kentucky has stayed safe from having to be overrun in their ICUs. That said, it also, as science evolves and we learn more things, one of the biggest lessons is in health communication. So early on, masks were not recommended, and then they were recommended when we realized that the spread, we always knew it spread by coughing, but that we could prevent 80% of the spread if people wore masks. So those are kind of the new findings. So getting to that knowledge sooner rather than later and disseminating the knowledge in a way that the public can embrace and understand.
Well, we seem to be doing a little bit better on the masking, if just my observations and observations of my colleagues are to be taken into account as we move around Lexington or Richmond or the area. Seems more people are wearing them. But what's your message to people who still refuse to wear a mask or practice social distancing when they're in public places where other people are gathered?
You know, it's such an important question, Tom, because we know that every person has agency to make decisions about their own health. The things that are most critical about this novel coronavirus is that we have so much what's called asymptomatic spread in the community. So people can have the virus and not know they have the virus and spread it to others. So we, as individuals, have a responsibility to our community, to our family, to our elders, who are at the most risk from this disease. So we owe it to our elders and to those who may be immunocompromised to wear a mask and not spread it if we have COVID and don't know it.
Dr. Donna Arnett is Dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Kentucky. Thank you, Dr. Arnett.
Thank you.
Many people working in medicine are on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic, and in many areas, the stress is serious. And physician burnout was already an issue prior to the arrival of COVID-19. According to a recent study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, one in two American doctors struggles with burnout. Dr. Sean Jones, a board-certified otolaryngologist, head and neck surgeon trained in robotic surgery, is president of the Kentucky Medical Association Foundation, and he has written a book about surviving physician burnout, and he joins us now. Greetings, Dr. Jones.
Good afternoon.
And we're hearing of burnout in many professions these days, and I understand that you yourself have experienced this, and we're going to discuss in a few moments what you did to pull yourself out of it. But could you tell us first what you experienced?
Well, it's been several years ago, but I actually had an episode that could be described as burnout, in which I became detached and noticed through the help of my wife that I was experiencing some of those feelings and difficulties, and I sought outpatient intensive counseling for that and recovered through primarily taking some time off and reappraising how I was working and the reason I was working and reevaluating those things, as well as some addressing some of the issues I had originally, and then some things to help me cope with that, such as mindfulness and getting into some other aspects of life, such as beauty and creativity and those, as well as family. All of those sorts of things helped me to really reinvent not just myself, but my life in a way that's kept me, I think, a lot healthier than I had been working previously.
Well, what are some of the emotional, physical, or behavioral symptoms of physician burnout?
Well, Maslach, who sort of characterized it after Freudenberger had originally named it in the 70s, said that primarily people experience burnout through three dimensions: emotional exhaustion, which really is a lack of engagement and feeling just like it sounds, worn out all the time; depersonalization, almost a robotic sense of working from the script and dehumanizing people you come into contact with; and then finally, a low sense of personal accomplishment, feeling as though the work you do doesn't really matter.
And so to get yourself out of that, to kind of hit the reset button, is it helpful to rethink the meaning and purpose of why you got into medicine in the first place?
Yes, I think ostensibly you can't really get yourself out of it, because it's sort of, as I describe, kind of like being a schizophrenic and trying to figure out what's real and what's not. You really don't have a good sense of what's going on and what's happening. You just know and you feel deeply that there's something wrong about this work that you did that meant so much to you to begin with. The passion with which one goes into medical school somehow has been lost, and you recognize that, but getting out of it requires, I think, some really, deft help. And so reconnecting with that purpose is really important, because one of the dimensions, as I mentioned, was a low sense of personal accomplishment. If you think of it on the face of it, it's very difficult to understand how medicine, which is so deeply steeped in philosophical meaning and purpose, could drive the purpose out of someone. So reconnecting with that is really, really important.
Which fields of medicine would you say are most at risk of this?
According to most of the data and the research that's been done, emergency medicine is very susceptible because of the type of work they do. The surgical subspecialties are very susceptible, and primary care physicians are also very high on the list.
How would a patient be able to tell that their doctor is going through this? It's probably a very uncomfortable position to be in, but is there a way that a patient can know?
Well, I think it's probably pretty difficult. I've been a patient myself, obviously, but to some extent, we are very good, and I say we as physicians are very good at hiding our personal problems. We're taught, to lay aside everything, and much as you would a Navy SEAL, to put the mission first. That becomes the primary important. That's one of the things that tends to get us into trouble, is we always are so good at putting other people first and the mission first, if you will, that we neglect self-care. And so I think as a patient, if your physician is, seems detached or uninterested or, tired, it could be difficult, because it might just be that they happen to be on call the night before and had a tough night, but it could be that it's more of a chronic problem. So,
you mentioned earlier that you sought some counseling, and I'm just wondering if physicians typically are reluctant to reach out for help.
The data would suggest they are very reluctant to reach out for help unless they have some kind of issue which prompts them to do so, from either a hospital or a board or other agency that oversees, quality medical care. And that's one of the reasons that I felt telling my story was important, because I didn't have any of those issues. And I think it was just a confluence of different factors that led me to be in a position to have the capacity to make that choice. But there's a lot of factors that are working against you to say, hey, I'm going to step out of my practice for 6 weeks and go get some help and try to make things better. And so it is very, very difficult to do that, but I felt it was important to let other physicians know that, it was possible to make that decision, and it could end up being one of the best decisions that you make in your life to put yourself first for a little bit.
Well, as a response to what you were going through, to your own fatigue, you sat down and wrote a book about it. It's titled Finding Heart in Art, A Surgeon's Renaissance Approach to Healing Modern Medical Burnout. And I'd like to ask you to briefly describe how engaging with art and with beauty can help an exhausted, harried professional in medicine or any field for that matter, regain some emotional health and stability.
Well, for me, my faith is really important. And so the paintings that, I found spoke to me the most were really those that were Renaissance in origin and detailed certain aspects of the Gospels or the biblical narrative. And they also spoke to me in a way about what it meant to be a physician, paintings such as The Return of the Prodigal and The Good Samaritan. And they spoke to a part of my inner being, which had been neglected, that creativity and beauty. Physicians see a lot of ugliness every day, particularly as surgeons. And as I mentioned, emergency department physicians, we see the body in positions and in places and in situations that most normal people won't see. And we learn to, sort of put that aspect of it aside. And I think in the process of learning how to do that, some of us don't ever process those feelings we have associated with those difficult things we see on a daily basis, and that detritus over a period of time will build up and make it more difficult for us to capture our humanity. And reconnecting with beauty and passion and purpose, as you mentioned, is part of what helps to awaken your humanity again.
How are you continuing that? How are you sustaining that?
So for me, there's data that suggests that if you allow a physician to do what he thinks is most important in his daily work 20% of the time, then you can have him do just about anything else the other 80%, and his risk of burnout is very, very low. So as you mentioned before, when you asked me the question, is connecting with purpose important? It's vital. So for me, much as in the group Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, carrying that message to other alcoholics is really important in keeping that alcoholic well. For me, speaking to other physicians and healthcare professionals about burnout is really important. And so that's part of what has kept me, I think, well, is connecting not only with my own self-care through mindfulness and exercise and getting plenty of rest and making sure I do the things that I know will help to provide me with connection and family and faith, but also connecting with that purpose I have about helping other physicians recognize their purpose and their risk of burnout as well.
Well, your book, Finding Heart in Art, certainly would serve as a resource for somebody who's going through this, but can you recommend any other resources that they might turn to?
Yes, so the Institute for Healthcare Improvement also is a great website with a lot of resources, as is the AMA site that has the Steps Forward campaign, which has a great deal to do with it. The Kentucky Medical Association a couple of years ago actually focused on burnout and had a Beyond the White Coat exhibit that displayed examples of physicians' hobbies, creative parts and of their lives and avocations. So the KMA has done a lot of work on that. Dr. Tony, I think, who you've spoke with, he's our president, is addressing community health through his year with the Be Well, Stay Well public health campaign. And part of that is focusing on not just encouraging Kentuckians, but physicians as well to take care of their physical and mental health. So there are a lot of good resources out there for people, particularly physicians, if they'll reach out.
Okay, and where can your book be found?
It's on Amazon.com, and I also have a website, Sean C. Jones, MD. You can find me through the internet.
Dr. Sean Jones, he's president of the Kentucky Medical Association Foundation and author of Finding Heart in Art, A Surgeon's Renaissance Approach to Healing Modern Medical Burnout. Thank you so much, Dr. Jones.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Coming up after the break, walking out of prison and into a pandemic.
We've had 6 months to get accustomed to what life is like now, and they are just put out, and all of a sudden everything's, the world's turned upside down.
How drugs and alcohol figure into pandemic life.
People are being asked to cope with things that they never thought they would be asked to cope with.
And racial justice and equality through the eyes of a high school senior.
It's just saddening that people think it's a debate that black people should be treated the same.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
What if you experienced this COVID life for the first time 6 months after the pandemic was declared? Ray Geringer traveled to Moorhead for the first in a series of reports about criminal justice in eastern Kentucky.
It's a gray morning in early September when I pull into the parking lot of Rowan County's Mountain Comprehensive Care Centers. Outside the front door, there's a bright yellow sign that reads Safe Space in bold black letters. Inside, I meet Kristen Tiedemann.
My name is Kristen Tiedemann. I'm the program manager and substance use counselor for the Mountain Comprehensive Care Center's Northeast Kentucky Reentry Program.
The program is made possible through the Second Chance Act, which supports state, local, and tribal governments, as well as nonprofit organizations that are working to reduce recidivism and improve outcomes for people reentering society post-incarceration. The Rowan County Reentry Program consists of substance use disorder treatment, mental health counseling, peer support, and case management services. Both pre-release inside the Rowan County Detention Center and post-release for participants in an 8-county area. The program was set to hold its first substance use disorder and group therapy meetings inside the Rowan County Detention Center on March 10th, 2020.
So we walk in to do our first group, and we have boxes, and we have all these materials, these notebooks. You know, we're loaded down, and we are so excited. And as we're standing in the office getting ready to go back to the cells, the governor is on the TV, and he shuts down access to all prisons and jails. So all of our planning, our scheduling, and everything ended. And that's when we were able to work with the jail and do new scheduling to determine how we could do it through the glass on the handset. And then now we do that every day of the week, as well as treatment groups over Zoom.
The COVID-19 pandemic has not only complicated the reentry program scheduling and logistics, it has also made the challenges experienced by folks getting out of jail and prison even more difficult. In an op-ed published in the Courier Journal on July 30th, 2020, formerly incarcerated Kentuckians and advocates describe the support systems folks reentering society need. They write, quote, "As a foundation for well-being, people need food, safe housing, medical care, and mental and behavioral health supports," end quote. Those supports can be hard to come by for formerly incarcerated people, even without a global pandemic. But release during the pandemic brings a whole other host of challenges, as Kristen Tiedemann explains.
Things are different. When they went to jail, life was one way, and it was what all of us knew. And then all of a sudden, we've had 6 months to get accustomed to what life is like now, and they are just put out, and all of a sudden, the world's turned upside down.
Angel Johnson was released from the Rowan County Detention Center on April 1st, 2020. Just weeks after Bashir's healthy-at-home orders went into effect. She describes how disorienting it was to come out of jail after 9 months inside to the middle of a global pandemic.
You know, when I went to jail, there was nobody even had heard, you know, talked about COVID. And then whenever it actually hit and stuff, when I got out just to see people walking around in the stores with a mask on, it looked like something out of a sci-fi movie, you know what I'm saying? Because you're kind of in shock, too, when you get out of jail, you know, when you've been in there for quite a while, just everything looks so different. People that haven't ever done time probably don't think about it, but just the way the sky looks, actually seeing trees, seeing flowers, seeing stores, seeing people other than the same few people you live with and your guards. There's so many things you don't see, so everything looks so different anyway. And then to go into a grocery store and have only a few people in there and everyone being masked up, it was like it released into a sci-fi movie, honestly.
Eddie Sloan was released from the Rowan County Detention Center on March 9th, just 3 days after Governor Andy Bashir declared a state of emergency in response to COVID-19.
Well, when I first walked out of the building, I got to see my son for the first time, you know, besides on the video visit. And then we drove to the next county over where my girls was, and I got to see them. It was pretty exciting.
Was he born while you were inside?
Yes. Oh, yeah, yes, wow. He was born while I was probably 6 months after I got in.
What did it feel like to get to hold him for the first time?
It was a good moment.
Yeah. And then since then, what's kind of happened for you?
Well, we all are back together in the same house, you know, it was kind of hard getting a job with COVID. It took me a while because everything was shut down when I first got out. And then it stayed shut down until probably July when everything started opening back up. I finally got a job.
Incarcerated people are 5.5 times more likely to get COVID-19 and 3 times more likely to die from it than people who are not incarcerated. That's according to a study from researchers at Johns Hopkins and UCLA, published July 8, 2020, in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And COVID-19 outbreaks have run rampant at prisons and jails across the Commonwealth. Governor Beshear commuted the sentences of over 1,800 people in Kentucky jails and prisons who are medically vulnerable or were less than 6 months away from completing their sentences in response to the pandemic. While neither Angel or Eddie were on the list of those released early due to COVID, they both described what it was like to watch the pandemic develop while incarcerated.
I watched it all the way from the beginning whenever it started in China on the news, so I knew about it before a lot of people around here even knew about it.
Mm-hmm. And were folks kind of worried about it?
Not at first, because, you know, like Donald Trump was saying that it wasn't going to hit the United States, and then 2 weeks later, there we are, everybody in the United States was getting it. Yeah, they was worried about it because you can't go nowhere. You can't get away from it. And when somebody was getting sick, they would quarantine the whole cell. So that was a little bit of a worry.
Angel described the scene in her cell every night when the governor's 5 o'clock address came on the news.
Basically, it was a rule at 5 o'clock, everybody stopped talking. Like, nobody was to talk because so we could listen to the news. We watched Andy Beshear every day. You know, and it was just crazy when it started doubling, and it was scary because we would sit there and watch which counties had it, you know, and that's the way a lot of the girls would, you know, they'd be worrying about their family and stuff. So it was really hard. And plus not being out here to see any of it, just only getting your information from the news, it was very scary. Because I'll just tell you, at one point I was scared that when my release date came that maybe they wouldn't, because I thought maybe someone in the jail got COVID. Possibly they wouldn't release me because I would be like a danger of spreading it to other people. That was a real fear of mine, was that when I did serve out my time, that I wouldn't get to go home. And that was a scary thought.
Angel also describes the disappointment that she and other women in her cell felt when in-person visits to the Rowan County Detention Center were canceled.
That was very, very hard on most of us. You know, some people didn't get visits because their family lives so far away. But like, I'm from where I was in jail at, so I got visitation twice a week, you know, 2 15-minute visits, and it was very, very hard for me because I couldn't see my daughter, my two grandbabies, or my son. I couldn't see them, and it was a big adjustment.
Angel and Eddie both say they found the support that they received through the reentry program helpful. Angel was initially released in September of 2019 after serving 3 months of her sentence. She was sent to a residential rehab facility, but it didn't work out, and before long, she ended up back at the Rowan County Detention Center. I asked her about the difference between getting out of jail without the support of the reentry program last fall versus this spring as a participant in the program.
Well, I could honestly say the biggest difference for me is getting released before and not having any of these resources. And now that I do have these resources, it's so helpful because, you know, when you're a felon, it's really hard to gain employment. It's really hard to do a lot of things, you know, and people mostly just look at you like you're still a criminal, even though you could have changed and, you know, got your life completely together. They don't see that a lot of times. And I think this program really helps with that because they know that we're coming in here, you know, they know that we're staying sober, and it really helps us with getting employment and getting a lot of resources.
While the Rowan County Reentry Program is still in its first year, Kristen Tiedemann hopes that through data collection, they'll be able to prove how effective reentry efforts are at reducing recidivism and at saving state and local governments money.
One of the things that we'll be doing with our research is a cost analysis to see what kind of reductions have been made by people not being reincarcerated. So hopefully all of those things will help to be able to convince lawmakers that this is where the money needs to go. We don't need to build more jails. We need to help the ones that are getting out to stay out.
In Moorhead, Kentucky, I'm Ray Geringer.
Ray Geringer's report begins State of Justice, a series exploring issues related to the criminal justice system in eastern Kentucky. The series is provided to Eastern Standard by Ray Geringer and Amelia Kirby with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and a grant from the Vera Institute of Justice. And the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky is a supporter of WEKU. How did drugs and alcohol figure into pandemic life? For some perspective, we're turning to Lon Hayes, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Kentucky, with a focus on addiction and substance abuse. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Hayes.
Thanks for having me.
And I'd like to get started by asking you to share some general observations that you've been making about addiction and substance abuse as they relate to this pandemic.
Recovery from substance use disorders is often referred to as a very personal venture. So the issues and factors that go into recovery during a pandemic can be unique to each individual, but we have been able to make some generalized observations about this process.
Okay, and we're going to get into some of those observations. Let's start with sources of stress that are maybe peculiar to this situation that might be driving people to seek more relief in alcohol or drugs or maybe both.
Whenever someone is confined to their home setting, it can be viewed as a positive or a negative. For example, if the individual struggles with a lot of marital or relationship discord or problems with their children at home, being confined to the home becomes intensely stressful for the individual. We know that some people will increase their alcohol use in this setting. Others will increase their drug use in this setting. But we also find that some people are less tempted to use with the idea that bars and public settings have more restrictions on them now. We do know that alcohol sales have increased from groceries and liquor stores during this period of time. Whether that more than offsets the dollars that are spent in a bar setting, we're not sure. But it is pretty clear that more people are drinking at home.
Is it possible to know right now with any certainty whether self-medicating might be on the rise?
It's a good question. We know that self-medication often starts in early formative years. For example, the middle school or early high school student who has trouble with being in public without being very anxious and feeling like they're the focus of others' attentions, learn that alcohol is a good way to alleviate that. Unfortunately, this sometimes takes on a life of its own, particularly if that individual is genetically predisposed to addiction. We also know that people learn to self-medicate sleep problems and anxiety with substances such as cannabis, which also can take on a life of its own in terms of a substance use disorder.
We're dealing with an awful lot of uncertainty, and uncertainty can lead to behaviors that might not otherwise emerge. Do you think the uncertainty that we're experiencing is one of the drivers toward self-medication, toward perhaps returning to addictive behaviors?
I think it certainly can be. People are being asked to cope with things that they never thought they would be asked to cope with. For example, we know that a number of individuals have lost their jobs in this situation. We also know that a lot of those are blue-collar jobs and involve individuals who maybe don't have months and months of savings on hand. This becomes a real source of stress, which people can use maladaptive coping mechanisms. We know that people that have good coping mechanisms have lost some of those during this time. The most specific example I could give is the individual that looks forward to their gym workout at the end of each workday. And suddenly gyms and those kinds of facilities were closed and have gradually reopened with some restrictions involved. So people that used exercise as a coping mechanism in a very positive way have sometimes lost that, particularly if they relied on yoga classes and exercise classes as opposed to just being out on their own running or walking or riding a bicycle.
AA meetings, which are so key to those in recovery and those sustaining that recovery, have gone virtual. How's that been working out?
That's a really interesting question. I'm a strong proponent of self-help meetings, notably AA and NA, even though I'm also a fan of medication-assisted treatment. Many people have relied on recovery meetings to make contact with others who have substance use disorders, to make contact with a sponsor who can be like their addiction coach in their recovery. Some individuals do not have the technology at hand to be able to do this. Some people have the technology, but just really don't connect with it in the same way. And some who are very technologically adept have done fine with it. But there were an absence of these meetings early in the pandemic. Online meetings began happening, and some people are totally fine with that. Others don't connect with it in the same way. So that has been one of the most significant parts of the pandemic in terms of individuals pursuing their recovery.
You just mentioned medication-assisted treatment programs. I'm wondering, does the success of such a program rely on people being able to come in physically for screenings and counseling?
For the most part, the medication-assisted treatment programs have become a hybrid where some people connect online via Zoom or other platform, and some come in person. The inherent risk here is very obvious in that individuals with an opioid use disorder are much more susceptible to COVID-19 because of other health problems and because of self-destructive behaviors. So it has really been an interesting time in medication-assisted treatment programs. What we have seen is that some people have dropped out. We assume that that is often due to a relapse, but there has been an increase in the number of people seeking treatment. So an increase in the number of new patient evaluations that have taken place in that program.
What sorts of triggers are beginning to emerge that you're seeing that are leading people to relapse?
Relapse triggers can be very specific to each individual. For example, AA has a saying that is the acronym HALT, H-A-L-T, which refers to don't get too hungry, too angry, too lonely, or too tired. So that's been in place for a long time and still has some real implications for everyday recovery in individuals with substance use disorders. The other stressors that are more prominent right now have to do with aspects that one would not have expected, such as job loss, financial issues, children being home from school, not having appropriate child care. All of those can serve as significant stressors and significant relapse triggers. Years ago, when I worked in an inpatient treatment facility that had a 30-day program, we did a survey and learned that out of 200 admissions with folks that had previously been in treatment, that 175 of those said that they relapsed because they had quit going to meetings. So I find that very significant in this time where meetings have been taken away from a number of individuals unless they have been successful with joining those online.
Are you seeing an increase in suicidal thought and in the act itself?
We see headlines on a daily basis that suicide rates are increasing. Unfortunately, the figures tend to lag a year or two behind. So we won't have final figures on that probably even until late 2021 or early 2022. But we do know that in specific subgroups that rates are increasing. For example, in the opioid use disorder population, we know that there have been an increase in overdose deaths, some of which obviously have been suicides.
Well, we can certainly talk about the downsides of this thing that we're going through. I'm also wondering what kinds of positive coping skills people might use to help them deal with this situation.
One of the things that I always work with in my recovering individuals is how to cope with difficult situations and how to deal with relapse triggers. I personally find that many of these individuals end up relating very well to the idea of exercise as an overall way to improve their lives. It's a healthy coping skill, plus it has obvious health benefits in terms of cardiovascular benefits, musculoskeletal benefits, for example. I find that the people that are able to do that in a safe group setting or having one or two other people that they could run with or walk with find really good camaraderie with that. And the camaraderie is something that people miss in the self-help group setting like AA and NA. other kind of successful coping mechanisms, I've seen more people start mindfulness. I've seen more people start yoga. I've seen more people take on new hobbies such as music of some kind, reading, walking, that have been very, very positive for them.
Dr. Lon Hayes is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Kentucky. His focus is on addiction and substance abuse. Thank you so much, Dr. Hayes.
Thank you for having me.
We've heard from teachers and superintendents. Now our series on education in a pandemic turns to students. Here's series co-host Cynthia Reeser.
Today we're talking to Daylen Kozert, and Daylen is a senior at Carter G. Woodson Academy in the Fayette County Public Schools. And Daylen's school is unique in the district because it's an all-male preparatory academy for grades 6 through 12, and his school has a rigorous curriculum that teaches the students through a lens of African Americans and their culture. When Daylen graduates, he's going to already have 20 college credits through the dual credit program, and he's very busy. He's an athlete. He's the offensive lineman on the Frederick Douglass High School football team, and he's also an officer and active in several clubs, including student government and the Future Farmers of America. So today, Daylen, let's talk about your experience with the pandemic in America. Earlier, we talked about how this has been a year of not just one, but two pandemics. So first, let's talk about COVID-19. Tell us how that's impacted your education.
Well, I feel like it's impacted my education, you could say, in a negative and a positive way. The negative way would be like I wouldn't be face-to-face with students and teachers, which is probably like the optimal way of learning. Probably like the most important way of learning, the better way. But a positive that you can get out of it is that it builds like self-discipline and prepares you for college in a way that even in college now that some students are taking online classes that they might we might have to do that next year. And the self-discipline part, it helps you with like getting rid of distractions and like focusing and zoning in on your work when you're at home. When there's a lot of other distractions, as like electronics and like TV that could be going on around you.
Yeah, you have to make your own schedule and stick to it without the teacher telling you what to do all the time, right?
Right.
So we've also talked about another pandemic that's going on in America. And this is a chronic pandemic around social and racial injustice. And of course, your school focuses on this some. So tell us how this pandemic is a part of the curriculum and how this fits into your school, your schooling.
Well, first I'll start off by telling you that division of Carter G. Woodson Academy is to educate, motivate, and activate the potential for excellence that lies within every male. And the way we like incorporate like the racial and social injustice into that is using all of my classes, we should get like at least one lesson a day that has to do with something about African-Americans. And something that goes on like currently today, like in some of my classes right now, we're talking about like the Breonna Taylor case. Like everybody knows what the decision that they just made on that, and like about like police violence and stuff going on in America that everybody is aware about. And we kind of just try to incorporate that into like daily curriculum.
How do you think that your experience at this special academy, College Preparatory Academy, has better prepared you? You mentioned earlier how when you came in sixth grade, you were one way, but you've changed a lot now that you're a senior.
Right. It's just like very hard, rigorous. It's not like any other high school. Like plus me and like maybe just a little bit less than half of our senior class are all taking dual credit classes. So it's pretty much just like preparing us for college. And you were right, like in sixth grade, we weren't all like really wanting to go to Carter G. But by the time we got to about eighth grade in high school, we realized that it's going to be for the better of us and that it's not going to do anything negative, but it's just going to help us all the way throughout the way. And we really bound like a brother. We build a brotherhood together that'll like pretty much is like never ending.
Well, that's great. You mentioned prior to this interview, and you just mentioned it a minute ago, that black-on-black gun violence is often mentioned when the issue of law enforcement and people of color comes up. And I think you had a very personal experience with this recently. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I did. One of my friends, Michael, he was just killed just a little bit over a month ago. It really just, it almost it just hit us different because what it wasn't expected. It's just like really saddening to hear. But again, like with that brotherhood piece of it, it was like a time when we all came together and bonded together to bring us just that much more closer to each other, just knowing what happened to him.
Well, thanks for sharing that. So, you know, we're going to look back at 2020 as a really unique year in a lot of ways. And, of course, there's been a lot of negatives. But could you tell us some positive lessons, some things that are going to stand out to you when you look back on this year?
Well, one lesson that I really think that we learned this year, especially in my household, was that God can stop you like dead in your tracks at any point. And you got to learn how to like just keep pushing through and follow his path, because he's not going to lead you in the wrong way. So we just teach in our household that that whatever he does is for the better of us. And it's almost, you could say it's a negative, but it's a positive in our eyes, because everything he does is a positive.
Anything else that you might share with us that you might look back and tell your grandchildren? Oh, remember back in 2020?
I'd say first thing I say is obviously about like the COVID-19, how it impacted like school and stuff. But the most important thing that I probably say to them is about like the police violence and the social and racial injustice that that like Black people are getting, African Americans in general. It's just saddening that people think it's a debate that that Black people should be treated the same. I think it's just common sense that everybody should be treated the same. And right now, some people don't believe that.
I think you're right. I think you're right, Dalen. It is common sense. And I really hope that when you are looking back and telling your grandchildren about this, that both of these problems will be solved and they won't be problems that we have to face in the future.
Yes, ma'am.
I really appreciate you talking to us today.
I appreciate you for having me.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.